Good morning, sir. Before we get started, what is your name, sir?
Donald Shelton.
Thank you, Mr. Shelton. And at this time, the Honorable Mr. David Neal will be chairing your hearing, so just hold on and he'll be with you very shortly. And welcome to the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency this morning.
Thank you very much, sir.
Good morning, sir. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Yes, you have a phone. Do you have more than one?
I have one.
Okay, before you get started, may I just go ahead and make this phone call?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you, sir. Participating?
My daughter. It's Donald's daughter and my daughter. And yes, she's here.
Okay, so Mr. Neal will call upon both of you at the appropriate time. So the next voice you will hear will be that of the Honorable Mr. David Neal.
Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning.
And you can hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right, Mr. Shaw. Would you please state your full name and agency number for the record?
Donald Shelton, 057744.
Thank you, sir. You're coming for the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency this morning for a parole hearing. Would you wish to render parole, lapse of discharge, or home arrest? Let me introduce the board members who will be conducting the hearing this morning. To my left, which would be your right, is the Honorable Ruth Canoes, and to my right going this way is the Honorable Dr. T.T. White, who is a board chairman. To his right, the Honorable Gail Rittenhouse, and to her right is the Honorable Michael Johnson. My name is David Neal. I'll be your panel chair this morning.
Good morning, sir.
Okay, we're going to go over some information. I'm going to need some information and verify accuracy and stuff as we go along, and then once I'm done with that, I'm going to give you an opportunity to speak to us about everything, and then we'll let your supporters speak. Okay?
Okay, sir.
All right, so this is the board hearing. You were certified for this hearing by the Department of Corrections on April 1st, 2018. You're 49 years old and you're serving a life sentence for first degree murder, which began June 14, 1985. Originally, you were also sentenced to a 21-year sentence for kidnapping, which was a concurrent sentence, and so it was expired. These were from a rather gruesome beating and murder that occurred on May 31st, 1985, when you were 16 years of age. There were two other defendants in that offense. You were found guilty by a jury. Then, after you served the time of the war, July 8th, 2013, you were granted a home arrest. Then on February 10th, 2014, you were found in violation of conditions of release, but you were reinstated to home arrest by the Board of Executive Clemency. Then on March 9th, 2015, you cut your monitor strap, removed the GPS device, and then left state. A warrant was issued, and subsequently you were arrested in Mexico that same night after being involved in a traffic accident. As a 10-year-old homeowner, you were convicted of monitoring device, which is a felony and a crime, and received a two-year sentence, which has expired now. Moving on, June 1st, 2015, after all that in your trial, for the Board of Executive Clemency, you revoked your home arrest, but you've been denied a release during the last three hearings. So in that brings us to today's hearing. Now, when you were originally released on home arrest, you had presented information to the board which indicated you were ready to be released, returned to the community, without returning to any criminal activities, criminal ways. You had a minor hiccup there, but the board did find you in violation, but returned to home arrest, felt that you were worried about you would be able to continue on the release. My understanding of what happened when you decided to cut your device is you wanted to get out of Arizona, and so you cut the device and got the car and left, and you were heading across country, but had an accident in New Mexico while you got kind of hung up. Because the parole office was on top of things, they were able to get a warrant into the national system before that accident, so you were picked up on that warrant. So, without going all the way back for too many details, I'd like for you to give us a little bit of information about what was going on in your life when you had the original offense, the original arrest when you were 16 years old, a little bit about what was going on there, and then the summary of what you did while you were incarcerated to prepare yourself to return to the community. Then after that, we'll discuss your release and the rearrest and those sort of things. Okay, sir?
Okay. When my crime took place in 1985, like you said, I was 16 years old. I was living on my own. I wasn't living with my family. And a friend of mine, who was one of my co-defendants, was boyfriend and girlfriend with the victim's stepdaughter. And, I really don't want to make excuses for what happened. But I can only say that, we were all three manipulated into this whole situation by the victim's wife. Of course, nothing ever happened to her. But that's the truth of the matter. She was convincing my friend Bobby Lopez, who was a co-defendant, that she was being beaten, and her daughter was being beaten, who was pregnant at the time, that there was domestic violence, abuse, and everything else, and she had convinced us of this. But then later we had found out that she had put an insurance policy on the man, and which she collected after this was done. As I said, I make no excuses. It was not the correct way to go about it. We should have contacted the authorities and said, hey, look, this is what's going on. You need to remove this man from this home. But that's the gist of what got me involved in it. It was one of my friends who introduced me to all this. Ultimately, he ended up taking a plea bargain for 13 years, while myself and my other co-defendant still got 25 to life sentences. As far as what I've done in prison to prepare myself for release, I've spent over 30 years in here. Not all of it was productive, but I spent about 7 or 8 years writing a book for a homeschool curriculum out of the Oregon Institute of Science and Medicine called the Robinson Homeschool Curriculum. You know, they published the book, put the lessons as part of the curriculum. You know, I've done numerous courses through the mail, you know, correspondence courses through that institution as well as other places. You know, I've tried to, you know, I've also stepped away from all the negative activities that I had done in the beginning of coming to prison. You know, I've done everything I can think of as far as what's offered for lifers in the Department of Corrections. And, you know, and believe me, there's not very much of it. But I've done everything that I could possibly do to prepare out there. Although, when I got out, I discovered I was not prepared, because what you learn in here really doesn't equate out there. You know, life experiences that you deal with out there on a day-to-day, you know, a day-to-day basis, come at someone such as myself a little fast. And, you know, it took some getting used to. I bumped my head along the way, but I was figuring it out.
Okay. So, yeah, there's included in the packet, there's quite a number of certificates and stuff for programs that you've taken and things that you've done to improve yourself along the way. Also, I noticed that your discipline over the years was not too terribly bad. But in 2017, after you were revoked, after you accepted the vice and come back to prison, you had some tickets that were dismissed. I think it was for drugs, which doesn't mean you weren't in possession of them or around them, or they just mean you did whatever the charges were dismissed, which is a good thing. But then in February of 2017, you had a disorderly verbal ticket. You were found guilty, and that is a major. So that was a little over a year ago. So tell me about that. What was going on that you got in trouble a year ago?
Well, somebody had handed me something, a battery with some plastic on it, and asked me to pass it to somebody else is what it was. They would come across the fence from one side of the fence to me, or to somebody else, and then gave it to me to pass. I didn't know what was in it. I flushed it down the toilet instead of giving it to the officer. And that was what it was. And then come to find out, it turned out to just be some kind of note from one friend to another. But I had no knowledge of what was in it when it happened. And I shouldn't have cared. I should have just not minded my own business and not been involved in it at all.
So what about the disobeying of verbal?
That's the one I'm talking about right there. That's what it was. It was the officer asked me to get on the wall, and I turned around and put it in the toilet.
Okay, so. All right. I didn't play with it. So what did you say it turned out to be in the packet you flushed?
A note from one inmate to another inmate.
Oh, okay.
Just a note, yeah. I had no idea what it was, though, until afterwards.
Okay. So let's get down to the business of the first time that you were in front of the board when they reinstated you, even though they found you in violation. What did you do then?
I had been drinking NyQuil, and alcohol was tested for in a UA task. I had no idea that you could pop dirty for NyQuil, first of all. But you know, the parole officer did tell me, hey, look, you need to read the labels of what you're drinking. But I didn't have any idea that that was going to be the case. And that's exactly why they reinstated me. Is, you know, they knew that I was doing all the right things out there. I was working and everything else. But NyQuil does come up dirty positive for alcohol, as many other things do. But that was one particular thing that I was doing.
Yeah, there's a lot of kids that get drunk on NyQuil intentionally. Okay, so then we move on. They reinstated you. And then about a year after that, you decided to cut off your monitor. What? Why did you want to do that? I mean, you spent a lot of time incarcerated. You finally got out, and you had one round of almost going back to prison for the Nyquil incident. So why would you cut your monitor and leave the state? I mean, that's pretty serious compared to what you know anything else you could have been doing, drinking or. Getting caught doing illegal drugs, but to cut your monitor and then abscond from the state. What was going on? Why would you do that?
Well, there were some circumstances on the 7th. Okay, this all happened on, what did you say, March 9th, I think. On the 7th of March was a Saturday night. The parole officers came to my house. The supervisor, Steve Butcher, and some other ones, I don't know all their names, but they came to my house for a search. They searched my bedroom and my bathroom for hours. And I'm not talking about like 1 or 2 hours, I'm talking 3 or 4 hours they were in there. Well, then they didn't find anything in my bedroom, so they went to my father-in-law's bedroom. They found 4 guns outside his gun safe in his bedroom. Now, he had moved out from Texas with my wife and I and had brought guns with him, which was approved by the parole officer as long as they stayed in the gun safe. Well, 4 of these guns ended up outside the safe. 3 of them were my stepsons who had been living at our house previous to all of this, and he was in the process of moving when all this happened. So Steve Butcher finds all of these guns and puts me in handcuffs immediately. And, you know, of course, he also found 2 weed pipes in my office, which my stepson and his wife had been living in while they were staying with my wife and I. And so they put me in handcuffs, and this goes on for another 2 hours of me sitting on my couch in handcuffs and him telling me just what a dirtbag I am because, you know, of my past and how I have access to guns. And the truth of the matter is I had no knowledge of those guns being outside the safe. I never went in my father-in-law's bedroom, just like he never went in mine. So anyways, he asked me, can you pass a drug test? And I said, absolutely. So he says, well, we're going to do this mouse swab on you, and if you pass this mouse swab, we will deal with this on Monday in my office. And I said, okay, fair enough. So they do the mouse swab. I'm clean. I have no drugs in my system. So while this is going on, mind you, there's several parole officers searching my residence. And like I said, now we're getting into the 4 or 5 hour mark of this going on. And while I'm getting this mouse swab in my laundry room next to the kitchen, I hear 2 parole officers talking. And one of them says to the other one, hey, I don't know why we're not taking him in tonight. We're just going to violate him on Monday anyways. And even Mr. Butcher, when I talked to him about this later, said, yes, I was ambiguous, but I wasn't going to violate you. And he used the word ambiguous because he knew. And I'm not to say that, look, I made a terrible choice by cutting this thing off, but I was so overwhelmed with the fact I lost control of my house. I'm thinking at this moment I've just lost everything that I had going, and I was going to get violated for something that was out of my control. So that's when I made that choice, which was obviously, you know, I've been back 3 years now. You know, that I shouldn't have made. But I really felt at that moment that my choices were God, I just want to just give up, you know. No matter how hard I try, there's always somebody that's trying to be against you. You know, you would think the parole office would be there to help you. I never got one single piece of help from the parole office. Everything that I accomplished, I did with my family and myself and hard work. And here I was sitting there listening to 2 parole officers talk about I'm going back to prison on Monday for something that I had no control of. Well, I should have control because it was my house, but I had no knowledge of. And you know, at that moment, I think I just snapped and I just gave up. you know, like I said, which was the wrong thing to do.
So what was your destination when you took off?
I was going to go to Oklahoma, to one of my cousin's house, and I don't think I had a plan, sir. You know, I was so, you know, I had thrown up my hands and said, you know what, I just don't know what to do. You know, the truth is now, after going through this and recognizing that I'm not really, you know, I could have went down to the parole office, sat down with Steve Butcher and told him, look, man, I lost control of my house. It's not going to happen again. And after talking to Mr. Butcher, after all of this happened, and he told me, he said, look, man, you could have talked to me. Well, you know, why did his officers sit there in earshot of me saying that if they had no intentions of violating me on Monday? He said they were speaking of somebody else. That's what he told me his answer was. They were talking about somebody else, Donnie, not you. And I don't know. I have no real plan, sir. I just basically threw my hands up at that point, and, you know, I had no plan, so...
It seems to me that if they didn't actually take you into custody after they got them their search and everything, that you should have been comfortable with the idea that they were going to talk to you about it, and that you might have been able to avoid reincarceration and just get some sanctions for it. And you've been out of prison for a little over a year. So
almost two, yeah.
You know, so at that point in time, I would think, because you've been to some point before, and because you had a plausible story, and you didn't have, you know, it's like there, they found the guns, they're in a different room, they're out of the safe, but, you know, there's sometimes that can be explained away. It's not like you had a bunch of drugs and everything else going on in there, and you were clean. So that that helped to substantiate what you're telling them about. You know, I'm sure at the time you're trying to convince them, hey, I don't know really what's going on. So I have to ask you a question. I noticed in this form packet that was prepared and given to us, that one of the first things it says, Mr. Shelton is suitable for reinstatement of parole. Okay, that's the paragraph, or that's the bullet point. Whatever you would like to call it, but it is that since your initial release to parole in April 2013, you've not been convicted of any criminal offenses, nor have you been accused of anything involving violence. For the violence part, I don't see any violence, but cutting the monitor strap is a felony. That's why they gave you a 2-year sentence for it, separate from the life sentence. And you were convicted of that. So it's and of course some of the other things that might have been related that night when they did the search and everything, their criminal activities there that they that you were scounded before they could make a decision what they were going to do with it. But according to the laws, if those guns were in the house and you have control of the house, which you did, you have keys for it, and that room wasn't locked separately. The way the law is for prohibited possessors, that's a crime, and you could have very well been convicted for that. It's another felony. So it's those granted, it might be explainable and no charges filed and everything, but that it's all there, and you have control of the house, and you're in there, and you can have things in your office and your bedroom, even somebody else's bedroom, if the bedroom's not locked. That's pretty serious. But my point being is that this is kind of made it sound like you really didn't do anything wrong, but scounding after cutting off a monitor is pretty serious. And it also would point people to the conclusion that you did have some involvement in the guns and in the pipes and the things that were found in your house, rather than you want to stand up and say, hey, wait a minute, I messed up, but I really didn't have control of that stuff. So I have another question about the information in our packet. There was a parole information handbook for the state of California.
Yes, sir.
What was the purpose of that? You were incarcerated in Arizona, the board was in Arizona, and we don't follow any of California's parole procedures specifically. We may have some similarities, but they're Arizona state law, not California. So what was the purpose of that being in your packet, sir?
Well, since I've been back, my wife has relocated to California, and we have done some research in the California system, because what I'm liking to do, what I'm asking is to be paroled to California. They're more equipped for, they have over 3,500 lifers on parole in San Bernardino County. Well, I think that's the whole state, excuse me. But San Bernardino County is the biggest county in the United States. And I wanted you guys to see that we have researched the parole department in California. And it's not like if you paroled me there that I would be getting less stringent, restrictions or whatever. They, you know, that's the handbook. They have what they call lifers parole out there, just for lifers, which Arizona doesn't have. They have programs set up for people to, you know, to reacclimate to society after doing 30 years in here, so that you don't feel alone and that you know what you're getting yourself into. You know, there's just more resources there. So we included that in the packet because we wanted you to see that we have researched this, you know, the situation out there. And they have the global positioning monitor, the GPSM, like they do out here as well. And it's not like I could get released from here and not get put on the same situation out there is what's going on out here. The only difference is the resources out there for post-incarceration syndrome and things like that, you know, job availability, the help that you get out there as far as four lifers alone is much greater than what I would get out here. Not to say they don't exist out here as well though, sir, because they do, and we have researched them out here as well. But we wanted to include that with the packet because that's my ultimate goal, is to be paroled out there and be back with my wife where she lives out there.
Okay, sir, the this board is the Arizona Board of Veterans Clemency, and any releases we recommend or vote for are to the state of Arizona. If you want to go to another state, you have to deal with the Department of Corrections, and then you put in an application to California, and California has to agree to take you. And all
yes,
that,
sir.
You know, takes time, but it's the only thing the board would do is, if you were so of mine, it would be to grant you home arrest again, and that's in the state of Arizona. Placement at that point in time is up to the Department of Corrections, not us. And then from there, you have to apply for an interstate compact agreement, and you may or may not get that. So it's a lot of time involved. I appreciate the fact that you gave us that information because of what you're doing. And it does, yes, it is a good thing that you've researched that so you understand. Because a lot of people think, well, they can just go to another state. They have no clue about what they're going to get into as far as supervision when they get there. Any of that stuff, so it's interesting information. I realize that it's been 3 years since you were revoked, and since all this happened, but it's pretty serious to catch a monitor and leave the state. So tell me what you've learned, what you've done, what you've accomplished in the last 3 years to convince the board that you would go out there and let it overwhelm you again.
Well, recognizing the fact that you can't catch up on 30 years of incarceration in a year or two, is something that I think that, is important to me. I had this plan that I could go out there and I could catch back up in 2 years. And, I work hard, I have a strong work ethic, I'm dependable, I'm loyal. And I thought, okay, I'm going to take this 2-year plan and put it into effect. and it just doesn't work that way. You know, I realize this, I have to slow down, I have to keep control of my life, not negative influences come into my life, such as my stepson bringing guns into my house that I didn't know about, weed pipes into my house that I didn't know about. These are things that I'm not going to let happen again. And I do realize that I will be put on home arrest again in Arizona. And I have a place to go at my sister's house, which is a stable place to go where I will be around people who care enough not to put me in positions where I have to explain myself to the parole officer. You know, I'm the only thing that I've really learned, well, I can't say the only thing, the most important thing I've learned is, look, I need to slow down, I need to take my time, keep control of my life, keep people out of it that are negative influences, and just slow way down. Don't try to catch up in a year or two, because it's going to take longer than that. And trust the people that are in my corner, like my wife and my stepdaughter, who actually have genuine concern that they're going to help me along the way, and I can trust them 100%.
Okay, sir, the, in reference to the guns, and you said your stepson, is that your current wife's son?
Yes, yes.
All right, that's just a matter of curiosity. Extended families can get very complicated. I'm very familiar with that, so. Okay, I'm going to see if my fellow board members have any questions for you at this time. Mr. Canomas?
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Mr. Shelton, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
I guess my concern, well, let me kind of back up here. I understand that you entered the correction system as a teenager, that you hadn't completely developed as an adult by that time, and without playing the psychologist, I think it's generally understood that people's emotional development is often stunted by the prison experience. My concerns are that you already had issues leading up to this crime, as far as this sort of history of running away. And the reason why you were revoked was for some extremely poor judgment. As my colleague had stated, you might have heard discussion between some parole officers during that search, but if they were going to hook you up, so to speak, they would have done it at that moment. I honestly don't believe that they would just leave the door open for you to abscond with you thinking that you were going to be revoked on the following Monday. And since you've been back in the prison system, your last ticket, which was last year, sounds like very poor judgment, considering what's at stake. You were able to be released from the prison system in your mid-40s, which I recognize isn't super young, but it's still with a lot of life ahead of you and with a lot at stake. Certainly a future. You stated that you have a hard work ethic, which I do appreciate. But the recent infraction is concerning to me because that shows an extreme lack of judgment. Even passing any sort of message inside the prison system, I think you must have known was taking a tremendous risk for your standing. So I guess what I'm asking is, what are you doing to bridge this judgment gap? Because that's something as one voting board member I'm very concerned about.
Well, after receiving that disciplinary infraction, you know, I think I realized, I know how serious this is. You know, guys in here that get disciplinary infractions, it doesn't affect them the same as it does me, because they have 85%. They get out after 85% here regardless, whereas I have to come in here and explain this to you guys. I think what it showed me that day was, you know what, I need to mind my own business. And my wife told me the same thing as numerous times. You know, why do you care? Get out of here. Mind your own business. Do your own thing. And that's exactly what it taught me. Look, I just need to worry about me and not worry about what everybody else is doing. And I, you know, and trust me when I tell you, I walk on eggshells all the time because any disciplinary infraction looks bad upon me. And the officers here in Stafford, where I'm at now, write up dozens and dozens a day for the smallest thing as a clothesline in your cubicles to not wearing your ID card as you walk to chow. You know, I pay attention to details and I make sure that I don't get, you know, disciplinary infractions. And that one right there taught me a valuable lesson. Hey, just worry about me and not everybody else. You know, somebody wants a no-pass, get somebody else to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Shelton. I have no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Neal.
Thank you.
Ms. Whitmer.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Mr. Shelton, I'm looking at your disciplinary record, and I see that you have, and I didn't count on the minors, but I see that there are five majors over the course of your incarceration, some in the 90s, but then there's one in 2008 and one in 2010, and one as recently as May, less than a year ago, that was dismissed on a procedural thing, which means it may have still happened, but the department did something wrong in its processing. These are all relating to drug possession or manufacturing. What were those about, sir?
Well, the last one that you spoke of, I don't remember if it, you said May, I think.
May 3rd of 17.
That was the search of the entire dorm by what they call an SSU special support unit or something, and they came running in the front door and the back door. Well, somebody in a cubicle across from me in two or three beds up threw a homemade syringe. It landed in front of my bed, not in my cubicle, but in front of it. The officer found it. He seen that it wasn't me that did it, but because it was closest to my cubicle, I was given a disciplinary infraction for it. Well, the man who actually did it stepped up and said, after I was already going to see the captain for the write-up, he stepped up and he said, hey, look, I did that. That was not Mr. Shelton. It was me who did that. And he took the write-up for it. It was him that did it. So it wasn't a procedural error. It was, hey, look, he didn't do it. This guy did it.
Okay. What about...
It is hard.
Yeah, what about the other... I see another one, same thing, in February of 17. Positive or refusal to submit to UA.
I peed clean in the cupcake. They had these faulty cups where the lines didn't show up for THC.
Okay.
It's a faulty cup. And then when they tested it, it came back that I was clean.
Okay.
But as far as up to previous before that, 2010 to the 90s, you know, I did have a different outlook. And I did do a little bit of drugs from time to time. Not an abuser of them, but obviously enough to get caught a few times.
What drugs, sir?
Well, I smoked pot a lot as a kid, and, you know, I dabbled with a little bit of all of them, but mostly marijuana.
Okay, so that's what most of these would be?
No, not all of them. There's one for some pills, I think, that I got a dirty UA for some codeine. That I had taken some pills.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Neal.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
So I'm just kind of going back over your packet and your record, and I wrote a little note in here that when Mr. Neal asked you what caused you to try to go out of state, you said you were going to Oklahoma and got stopped in Mexico and got arrested. But you said you snapped and just gave up. So,
yes.
So what's the difference between you being out on parole again and snapping and giving up?
Well, the difference is, you know, this time around, you know, it's been 3 years. You know, I spent 2 years out there building a life, getting jobs, working, you know, I got an OSHA card, lift certifications. I worked really hard. I worked 12 or 14 hours a day consistently. And I built up a life, you know, to where I had a wife, a house. I had a dog out there, you know, a 5-year-old dog. She's just awesome, you know. I got a boat. I built a life, and it was snatched away from me instantly because I didn't know how to deal with the stress of everything going on in my life at the time. There was so much more than just the guns in my house. It was fighting with my stepson because they were staying at our house for 5 months and not helping with any of the bills. While they had a house down the street, basically, that they paid rent on, they were still living at my house. And I had all these different stresses going on. And it was not just the parole situation that pushed me over the edge. It was the inability to cope with everything combined. And what I have to do differently is, like I said, I have to slow myself down. I have to realize exactly the situations that I'm in at all times, such as what Mr. Quinones just said about why would I pass a note to somebody. You know, unthinkingly, you do things sometimes that are detrimental to you that you have to be conscious of. And I have to work, you know, very hard to stay conscious of all of my parole guidelines and all of the people around me. And I do believe that I'll handle it differently. I also know that I can talk to Steve Butcher. After all of this happened and we talked on the phone, you know, he made a comment to me that, you know, someday he'll be on my caseload again. How are we going to do this differently? And I told him, hey, talk to me as a person, you know, a person, as a man, as an honest person, and I'll do the same in return. And I think, and he told me, you can talk to your parole officers always about what's going on. You don't have to, you know, hide anything that you're feeling or what's going on. Tell them the truth, and I will. And that's how I'll do it differently.
Okay, so that makes sense, sir. You're going to talk to someone as a honest person. I would hope that, but to talk to this board as an honest person. And I'm telling you that I'm having a little bit of problem understanding, you know, your logic and your reason. After you had been out, you came back before this board on a violation. Instead of the board revoking you, they reinstated you. And you back out, and then while you were back out, you said that simply over a conversation that you had, over a conversation that you overheard, you made a choice and a decision to cut the monitor off. You had been on the monitor for a while, so you were fully aware that once you cut that monitor off, that they were going to know that you had to cut that monitor off and left. You would know all of that information. It's not like, you know, you wouldn't know this information or you had just recently placed on parole. You had been on parole for a while and had been on the monitor. You fully aware of that. And then this situation is what's really bothered me is that last year, this situation that you explained, the way you described it, is someone threw something over the fence. You picked it up, and the guard told you to stop and bring it to him. You decided to flush it down the toilet. However, you had no idea of what you had, and you didn't find out until later on what happened. How did you find out later on what was in the package?
Well, it didn't go all the way down the toilet, sir. That and the lieutenant actually told me what it was. I didn't know until later because the lieutenant told me.
Okay.
But so, they have traps in the toilets, and I guess, you know, he said that it got caught up in the trap, and all it was a note.
Okay, so I'm just explaining. I mean, for someone to throw something over the fence, you to pick it up, you walk with it, you pass it, you flush it down the toilet. There has to be some arrangements to know that someone's throwing it over the fence and that you were the one who was supposed to pick it up, or just out the clear blue sky, someone threw it over the fence.
No, sir. It wasn't like that. It was somebody threw it over to somebody else. I was out by the phones on the rec field. The guy that the note was going to lived on the same dorm as me. And the guy that got the note asked me, hey, Donnie, can you give this to, I don't even remember who it was for, but he says, can you give this to such and such? I said, yes, sir, no problem. Not knowing that, you know, I don't know what's in it, but I'm thinking, you know, I have, you know, Mr. Johnson, I'm to be straight honest, I made a poor judgment, you know? I think it's one of those things where, you know, sitting back on it, looking at it now, it looks really like a dumb choice that I made, you know? As simple as passing a note to somebody can cause a concern in your mind like this. And I understand why. And, but the truth of it is it was done without thinking, and, you know, I haven't made the same decisions again, nor will I again after, you know, what I had to go through just for something simple like that.
And then that's what I'm trying to understand. You say you won't make that same decision. I'm trying to knock him something that really makes a difference in how you would have changed. You ran parole, put on home arrest, you violated, you got reinstated. You, after being reinstated, you violated again, and then not only violated, but cut off your monitor system and left the state. And then you were incarcerated, and while you're incarcerated just last year, you do something else. You make it sound as though, you know, it was just a dumb mistake, but these all kind of sound like they keep adding up to be kind of calculated, that that's a pattern that you continue to go through. I haven't seen a change in that pattern of you making these decisions and violating the rules or the regulations or the things that you should do. You simply take something from someone and you say passing it on is just a dumb thing. You, people don't just hand you something just to be handing it to you if you don't know who it is, if you decide to take it, and you know, you get observed by the correction officer with it, and then you decide to destroy it, try to destroy it. That's...
Well, sir, Megan, as far as a pattern of change, I've made a lot of patterns of change for the better, you know. Like I said, you can look at my disciplinary history from the 90s and the 80s all the way to now and see I don't get a lot of disciplinary. You can look at the pattern of change that I showed when I was out for those 2 years on home arrest, working every day and doing... building up everything that I was working for. You know, the pattern of, you know, making bad choices, that's not really, I mean, if you knew me 25 years ago or 30 years ago, you would see a totally different person than I was then. You know, I'm not making excuses, and I'm sorry if it sounds like I am, but what happened that day with that note was, you know, I watched these officers write 12 or 15 disciplinary infractions a day, some for less, some for more than what that was. But you can see that I've gotten one in 3 years of being back, and maybe one before that in 2010. My pattern has changed a tremendous amount for the positive. And, you know, like I said, you have to look at me and see the accomplishments that I worked for, you know, getting out of the gang style that was in here, writing a book, spending 7 or 8 years in a cell writing a book. There's a lot of changes that I've made for the positive, as well as when I was out working, you know, getting an OSHA card, which is not an easy thing to do. You know, I do believe that I'm fit for staying out this time and doing what I need to do slowly and properly.
All right, well, thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Neal. You said you're a changed person. I guess one of the things that caught my interest, sir, in the release plan is the last sentence there that you say you plan on looking into counseling for PTSD and post-incarceration syndrome. Why do you think that's necessary, sir?
Because it explains some of the symptoms of PICS explains the paranoia, the fear of always. You know, I was in fear so much every day when I was out there that it was just all going to be taken away in an instant. And it happened like that, exactly. At 2 years of building my life back, was snatched away in one day with one bad choice that I made. And I do believe that with some counseling and people that understand what it's like to get out of prison after 30 years, you know, not only was I a 16 or 2, I wasn't a 30-year-old man that came in here that already had a life. I came in here with no life and did 30 years. So I do believe that I suffer from some of those symptoms of BIGS, and I think that it would be in my best interest to get counseling on my own, and I will. I was mandated to go to AA meetings. Well, I would be more than happy to do any of the AA meetings again, but at the same time, I'm going to personally seek out a counselor that knows how to deal with this PICS and PTSD and post-incarceration syndrome, and find a way to relate how I'm feeling about everything going on, you know. I mean, little things that are common to you guys, such as a flat tire, or, you know, I had it happen to me where I went out to get on my motorcycle to go to work and my tire was flat. So I take my wife's car, I get a flat tire in her car. And, you know, I mean, simple little things like that that people know how to deal with. I didn't really know how to deal with it. It overwhelmed me for a second. You know, I had to get on the phone and call my wife, hey baby, what do? I got two flat tires. I've been stuck in the middle of traffic. You know, those are little things that I think that a little bit of counseling might be helpful. Because
and I can appreciate them, you know, sure. I guess what I'm trying to get at is that you, what I think I heard you say is that you, until this incident, you had some respect for the people, the parole officers, and of course you lost some respect as a result of the situation with the guns and so forth. But why didn't you go to, you didn't have enough confidence in them during that, what, almost 3 years that you were out, to have gone to them and say, can you help me? Can you help me provide some opportunities aside from, and those are good programs, and I'm not saying that the programs are not, but aside from AA and NA, but can't you help me get some help as it relates to the possibility that I might have PTSD or some other problems that I really need some help? You didn't have enough confidence in your parole officers to ask them for help, sir?
You know, sir, I think that I was understanding, or not, it wasn't that I didn't have enough confidence. My parole officer's name was Richard Ayala, which I knew him when he was a corrections officer. And so he was a really nice guy. He was fair. I talked to him numerous times, at least once a week we talked. But the truth is I don't think that I realized I had a problem until all of this happened. You know, I use the word institutionalization, and that's such an ugly word. And nobody wants to be defined as institutionalized. And, you know, I would hear people saying, well, you're institutionalized because you've done 28 years in prison. Well, I don't believe that institutionalization is the same thing. I think institutionalized is not being able to function without structure. And I mean, sure, everybody that's been in here for 25 plus years has some form of institutionalization. But to me, it's more on the lines of, look, I'm not institutionalized because I can function and I showed that I'm functioning. But I didn't even realize that all of these things were building up to something that I needed to deal with. You know, I could have talked to him, and I would have felt more than comfortable talking to him had I recognized it at the time.
So you recognize the fact. So what are some of the, maybe this is the wrong terminology that I'm going to use, but now that you recognize the fact that you may have some of these situations, what are some of the triggers? How do you expect to deal with them? Whenever you're released, how do you expect now? I know that I've got something that's not quite clicking at the moment. So how are you going to deal with them? What are the triggers? Do you see anything out there without, you know, psychologists and all of that, sir?
Well, I'm no psychologist by any means, and the only thing I can tell you is what I've read in different books, and I have read a couple of books on PTSD and done a course in here on PTSD. And the only thing that the triggers are is, like for me, it was the fear of losing everything was so great that I wasn't giving my best to everybody around me. I was emotionally shut down. When I hug my grandkids, I mean, it's awesome. I love my grandkids, and it's so awesome to hang out with them. But I felt like always in the back of my mind, the fear of losing those three little monsters climbing all over me. You know, when in reality, that was the greatest thing that I had. Yeah, I think now that, like I told you, I'm going to slow down. I'm going to look at what's going on around me. I'm not going to be scared to talk to somebody about it. You know, I don't, you know, I know it's not being institutionalized. It's something else. And I'm not going to be scared. Like, Richard Arnold would be the perfect parole officer now because I know I could go to him and tell him, or Steve Butcher, and tell him, look, man, here's what's going on. You know, and if there's something that I can do. Plus, you know, there's counseling. You can go on the internet now, as my wife did in the parole packet, and found stuff on post-incarceration syndrome and things that you can do, places. There's resources available, and I will find them to go with, you know, in some kind of counseling.
Okay, sir. Well, I can appreciate what you're saying. I guess one of my concerns, and I guess you're saying then that you overcome that, but I guess prior to talking to you and listening to you today, one of my concerns and still somewhat is you, and maybe I'm mishearing what you're saying, maybe I'm misinterpreting what you're saying, but in the past it seemed that you were basically blaming everybody else for what you were doing or what was not being done. You blamed the officers that day, or even when they came out there and found the guns and so forth, and they were whispering to each other. And have you gotten over that, where you just looking? I think it seemed to me that you've been blaming everybody else except your wife and your stepdaughter. But it seemed to me that otherwise, you know, everybody, you've been blaming them, sir.
I don't mean it to sound that way, because the truth of the matter is the only person responsible for me is me. And I make these choices. Like I said, for me to lose control of my house, that's my fault. Not the parole officer's fault, not my stepson's fault. For the strained relationship that I had with him because I wanted them to move out of my house, you know what? I have to work on that. You know what I mean? Trust me when I tell you, these things that happen are because of me, not because of anybody else. I mean, I'm using excuses, and I don't want to use excuses, because ultimately, I'm the one that did this. I'm the one that made this choice. And I'm the only one that can fix it as well, you know, and I'm not going to let it happen again, because I know I'm in charge. I'm in charge of my life. You know, sure, I have a partner, my wife, and I have a great sister and a great stepdaughter and, you know, great mother. And everybody wants to help me in a lot of different ways. But the truth of the matter is that I have to be in charge of my life, and I have to control what's going on in my life. And I need to slow down and stop allowing, you know, everything that just overwhelmed me, you know, and just take a breath and go, look, you know what, this is how you prevent this. You control it. You take charge of it. Don't let this come into your house. Don't let these things into your house. Make sure of it. You know, don't distrust that people have your best interests at heart. You know, make sure of it.
Okay, sir. Well, thank you so very much. That's all I want to ask at this time. Thank you so very much, Mr. Neal.
Mr. Johnson?
Besides something to do about this, something to just keep. You've said several times throughout the conversation with all my colleagues that things was just snatched away from you. And I don't see anything that was snatched away from you. It seems like everything you did say in the sin that only you're the only person responsible for your actions. And when you was last taken back in custody, things weren't snatched away. You talked about the black tire and the fear of losing everything, but you had an opportunity to enjoy all those things, and they weren't snatched away from you. You simply made a decision to give them up by violating your parole.
You're right, sir. And that's exactly true. I'm the one that made that choice. I messed it up myself. And I know that.
When you say
things, I won't let it happen again.
When you say things were just snatched away from you, make it sound as though, you know, someone did you wrong and just took all those opportunities away from you. They weren't taken away from you. You simply gave those up. Once when you cut that monitor, you knew what you were doing. And you knew what the consequences were when you cut that monitor. Even if you would have made it to Oklahoma, you knew that eventually you were going to be picked up, arrested, and taken back into custody. So it wasn't snatched away from you. You made a decision to give all that up. I know you talk about it, but you made a decision to give it up. And I don't really hear you saying that, you know, you realize that was, you did say it was a bad decision, but that the things, the positive things with your grandkids, or being able to hold them and being a fear of losing everything, that would, I would think that fear would make you not want to do something that's going to make you lose it, instead of having an attitude that they're just going to, PO or someone's going to take it away from you. But that just concerns you, sir. But I do, you know, appreciate you, so, for being at least straightforward with us, sir. So I'm going to turn it back over to Mr. Neal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Camones?
Yeah, one last thing. Mr. Shelton, again, I think I find this board very humane. I think we asked some hard questions. I guess my concern is this, and it's more of a, maybe in the form of a challenge, but it seems that when you were a juvenile, you had the propensity for running away to Oklahoma, and I think in the end you ended up running away to Oklahoma. So I'm hoping that you're thinking about breaking this cycle, because I was frankly, I don't want to say on your side, but trying to make a point that I actually believe in, that you were emotionally stunted, that your growth was stunted by going into the prison system at such a young age. But you're going to have to put this behind you if you want to safely return to the community. And I'll just end it there.
I will, and I have, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Kinnis. Do you have a follow-up question? Mr. Shelton, I have a couple other things that I thought of during our discussion. First of all, there are several things in the packet about the information about different programs that are available out there. Have you lied to anyone? Because, you know, we see a lot of acceptance letters for inmates that are trying to go on parole. And they go over and reach out to the halfway houses they think would be the best suited for them, and they make an application and get an acceptance letter prior to coming before the board. And part of that is if we were to grant you a return home arrest, you wouldn't get out of incarceration until you have an approved residence to go to, which means there's an investigation, by DOC and everything. And it, you know, could be your daughter-in-law's house or something like that, but you talk about programs to help you reintegrate. There are several very good organizations out there that specialize in returning lifers to the society without a problem. They've got like 6 month programs out there. And, they help you in every possible way they can to integrate you back into society, so that when you go, you're more or less on your own, you're prepared for it. But, there's information about some programs like that, but I don't see any letters from those, those programs saying they would accept you if you would be released. So have you applied to any of them, sir?
No, sir. I never looked into the halfway houses or any of those things because I have a place to go. I have my sister's house in Mesa, who she's an elementary school principal. Her and her husband live there. It's a really structured house. It's a good start. So I never really looked into the halfway houses because I have that. As far as the programs, it's really hard for me to do research. You can see that my wife is able to get on the computer and research these programs. And there's really not a lot out there about post-incarceration syndrome. You know, AA and NA, those things are widely available. You can find a meeting every day on any corner of Phoenix. But as far as finding counseling for what we're talking about with PTSD and PICS, I'd even went as far as to talk to the psych department here in the prison and explain to them, and they have no way of helping you as far as this goes. So the best thing that I can do is utilize what you see in there, and when I do get out, get on the internet and go online and research them and sign myself up for the classes. Because, and that's what I did when I got out last time as far as the AA and the NA. I did all that myself too. I found the meetings to go to and made sure I was there 3 times a week. But it won't be the same thing with this.
Yeah, my understanding of the DOC that pretty much every yard, unless you're on lockdown, has availability to go to NA and AA meetings, and it's pretty much available everywhere inside, not mm-hmm. to the outside. But we have inmates coming to us all the time that have, like I say, letters of acceptance, because they send out letters requesting, to be housed there. DOC makes a determination of exactly where you reside when you get out. And you may have a place that you think you can go that's great and wonderful, but at this point in time, DOC would look at your past history and make a determination. So you can request to go there, but they have to investigate that they have to accept that. And they might not accept that. They might say you have to go to a halfway house and spend some time before you're allowed to go to a private residence, and which is not unusual on home arrest. You've been out once before since you were violated and put back in. They can do that, and all I'm saying is that it boils back to some of the blame everybody else sort of thing. You've got it all figured out, but you didn't have it all figured out last time. So you need to have more roads available to you than just one, because that road might get blocked. The other thing is you're talking about PTSD. That's a big catchword right now. Everybody's got PTSD. Trying to get something done their way, and it's like all psychological disorders. It's extremely subjective, and it changes all the time as to what it is and what causes it. But generally, PTSD is just like it's named post-traumatic syndrome, and they're looking at a major trauma like back when you're 16, and what happened with LF might be considered that. Or getting beat up in prison. But anyway, there's other things too. Is it sounds to me more like what the psychologists call self-defeating behavior. You go along and you're doing really good, but you unintentionally, unconsciously get to that high point. You're almost successful, and then you pull the rug out from underneath yourself. You snatch it away from yourself. I've got a couple of kids that have worked with them to get them out of that type of behavior when they were in high school. So that's another thing to look at. But I have one question, and this is just more curiosity. Were you offered a plea agreement, or did you insist on a trial, or did you not even have an opportunity to make a plea agreement when this all happened originally?
My lawyer told me that they offered a plea bargain for 25 to life, and he rejected it because there was 3 sentences available for juveniles at that time, which was 25 to life, natural life, or the death sentence. And the plea bargain that he was offered on my behalf was 25 to life. He rejected it and said we were going to trial. I never even knew about it until after he had already told him no.
Okay, that was just more of a curiosity than anything else. Okay, if there's any questions from the board, I'm going to go ahead and ask your supporters to go ahead and speak on your behalf, if that's okay with you, sir.
Thank you very much. It's awesome.
Okay. I'm terrible with women names. Is this Mrs. Sheldon?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Would you like to go ahead and... talk to the board now, tell us what you would like to us to know.
I'm sure. I've been listening to you guys and you guys had a lot of the same questions that I did, actually, when we had violated. I remember when we got married that we were going to have obstacles that normal couples per se don't really have, but I didn't really grasp the extent of what those obstacles could be. I expected some psychological issues, you know, what you call it, maybe arrested development, things like that, which Donnie is very, very friendly. There is not, he's never met a stranger. That's why I was always on him about, you know, why do you have to be so interested in what the neighbors are doing? Let's pay attention to what we're doing, you know, because he's just always trying to help people, trying to be involved with stuff, so, you know. And me, I'm not so much. I never knew my neighbors until he moved in. As far as when he violated, one of the first comment that he made to me when we were able to speak about it was he told me that he felt like he couldn't control himself. Like, he had to go and he had no control over that. And I was like, what do you mean you have no control? So I started really trying to do some research into that, and that's when I went into the PIC syndrome. And it is a form of PTSD, but it's not... It's characterized, and it's several clusters of symptoms that are specific to incarcerated individuals. And according to what I've read, the younger a person is, and the longer they spend in prison, the more that makes them more of a candidate for this particular syndrome. However, if you were going to counseling, and which I know that I have access to private insurance now, so as far as having to depend on public resources for counseling for him, that's not the only resource. You can go to a private counselor where they can talk to him and come up with an individualized treatment plan and go to group therapy where he can talk to other people that are having the same thoughts and the same things going on with him, so that way he realizes that there are other people that are having the same problems and he's just not out on his own on that. As far as what to do differently about everything that, you know, that happened before, I don't have any contact with my son and his wife because they're pretty manipulative and constructive individuals, and I don't personally need that in my life, and I know that Donnie doesn't need it in his either. As far as my dad goes, his mental capacity deteriorated quite a bit, and it got to the point where of course I'm able to get rid of all the guns, and now he doesn't even live with us anymore because he just has He just won't cooperate with pretty much anything. He doesn't even work with anymore either. I mean, I've reading all of that out because I do realize that I need to focus my focus in a different direction, and I need to focus more on what we need to do for our own lives and for ourselves and not worry about anything else. And at this particular point, that's the thing. We're not worried about anything else or anybody else. I'm focusing on what I can do professionally in my career and also to keep the resources there for Donnie, such as the life insurance and the health insurance and the things that he's going to need and does need now. And I didn't have access to those things before. Here in California, if I can, you know, if we can, you know, apply to the interstate contract and have him transfer here, they have what they call high-risk parole. And that's probably where Donnie would fit in, because with high-risk parole, it's people who have either been sex offenders, if they've been gang-related, or if they had an original violent crime, which two of those categories he fits into. With the high-risk parole, that's also GPS monitored, so he'd be on an ankle monitor here as well. And the difference between Arizona and California, if you actually looked into the COLE packet, they have specific departments to help with job opportunities, to help with health, to help with mental health, and it's all under one roof. You don't have to go anywhere to look for it. They have that department. You just go in there. And so it's for that reason, I think that, you know, that helps a lot. And like I said, through the private insurance. And, you know, California is big on counseling. They think everybody needs to be in therapy for something. So, you know, I'm sure it would be very hard to find. But, you know, just trying to refocus and do things differently and concentrate more on what his problems are, because I didn't realize until this violation, I really didn't realize that there were those problems either, because he never voiced those things. And I think that a lot of his problem was that he didn't want to disappoint me, or that he thought that I had expectations that I didn't have, because we just really didn't talk about it. And, that's a lot more communication and a lot more paying attention to what's going on as far as he's concerned. I think that he would do a lot better, because he's done a lot of talking over the last couple of years, and it's crazy that it may be a proven thing due to a relationship, because you can't get distracted on anything else. You go for a visit, and all you do is talk about the things that went wrong, and I think that you can be different. So we've talked about it for the last 3 years, and we have a completely different approach and outlook, and a different plan. So, I think that we'll work harder towards that. And I don't think that this will happen again, because, you know, he's 3 years older and 3 years wiser, and he does realize what he has to lose now, because the first time out, he didn't really have anything to lose, but now he does. And so I'm hoping for those reasons that, you know, you guys will consider giving him a chance to prove himself, because, you know, I think things have changed a lot. That's pretty much all I have to say about all that. Do you have any questions?
Well, I do have one question. Were you two married when he was released on home arrest the first time?
Yes, he was released on home arrest, and he lived in his sister's house. We dated for 6 months, and then we lived together from September until October. He moved in September, and then in October, for my birthday, he proposed, and then we were married April of 2014.
Okay, so when he you met him after he was released on home arrest.
Well, we met when he was still in prison, but we didn't date, or we were not romantically involved until he was out on home arrest. We started dating when he lived at his sister's house.
Oh, okay. So you did know him when he was released at that time. Okay. You said that that you would have to just consider yourselves as far as doing things and not, get involved with everybody else. Unfortunately, the board has to consider all of society whenever we make a decision about the lease, and we can make a lot easier decisions on a lot of things if the only thing we had to consider were the individuals involved directly at that time. But we have to consider the society in general that he's going to be released back into, and whether it's that best case in the best interest of all of the citizens of Arizona, or just the inmate. So that's something we have to consider when we're doing this. I don't have any more questions. Let me see if any other board members have any questions to you, ma'am.
Well, maybe I should clarify that a little bit, because I didn't mean not to consider anybody else. What I meant by that was, instead of being busy worrying about, I need to, pay this bill for this person, or I need to help the guy across the street, or I need to do these things, we need to concentrate on what he can do to improve himself and what we can do to improve our own lives. I don't mean not to consider anyone else, but by, concentrating on more what's going on right here is going to help everything that's going on out there ultimately. You know what I mean?
Right. Concentrate on yourselves, but in that concentration to consider the repercussions on other people before we do something.
Well, that's exactly what I mean by concentrating on ourselves and how, you know, if you're not thinking about the consequences, then you're just jumping into stuff. That leads into more situations that we don't need.
Right. Well, that's what I mean. That's what you're saying, is that you're going to concentrate on yourselves, but as you concentrate on yourselves and make decisions about what you're going to do, what's not going to do, you also consider how those actions will affect others out in society. So,
yeah, exactly.
It's not a total lack of consideration of them, but they're the secondary consideration, not primary consideration. Okay. We don't have another question. Did you, would your dad like to talk?
Yes. First of all, I'd like to thank the board for taking the time to consider the statement via telephone. My name is Tiffany. I'm Sherry's daughter. I'm Sarah's stepdaughter. Just like my mom, I would have preferred to be there in person, but with her OL surgery, she couldn't travel, and I broke my right foot. I can't drive. If it wasn't for that inability to drive, I would be there with or without my mom, just because he does deserve the support. From the time I first met Johnny, he's been nothing but kind and genuine and hardworking. I've seen so much personal growth in him over the last couple of years. He's constantly striving to do better for himself and maintain these healthy, positive relations with people close to him. I have a background in healthcare. In particular, I work, I'm a nurse in a correctional setting, so I can spot people with, you know, less than positive motives a mile away, and Johnny's exactly the opposite. He's kind and generous to a fault, and he desires nothing more than what the rest of us take for granted, just a chance to make the simple life and work hard and have his family around him. It's unfortunate, let's say, that some of his best qualities is also one of his weaknesses. He's kind and sometimes too trusting. I would even say a little naive sometimes. He's had to learn the hard way that you can't always see people at face value, even outside of prison. And he's trying to learn to balance that kindness and generosity with a little bit of self-preservation. It's just unfortunate that he has to be held to a slightly higher standard than the rest of us because he is under a microscope. He's held to a higher standard than the rest of us because on one hand, he's asked to explain why he made the decisions that he did, and within that explanation, it can be portrayed as blaming it on other people, and I really don't feel that coming from him. He's just explaining where his mindset was in certain things, and even though he may not be blaming the probation officers who came and searched the house, explaining how that affected him psychologically and how overwhelming that was for him. And it's hard for those of us who have not been in prison to understand just how differently it affects people like that, just how hyper aware they are of what people are saying and how it could be interpreted that it could be about them or whatever. And like I said, since he's held to that higher standard, it's unfortunate that those probation officers and their lack of professionalism affected him so negatively. And I think he, again, is just learning how to deal with all of that stuff and reaching out for resources and reaching out for counseling and stuff to help him learn all these coping mechanisms that, like, again, the rest of us take for granted. Because we've learned about his life experience and his life experience has been so limited. With all that taken into consideration, I don't think that should keep him from parole. On the contrary, I think that his desire to continue to grow emotionally and psychologically makes him even more of a candidate for parole. He was self-aware enough to see that there is a problem, and rather than try to get back on parole on some kind of procedural error or blaming everybody else, he has looked deep inside and said, okay, there was something I did wrong, there's something I missed, what can I do about it? And that's when he started looking into all of you know, PTSD takes in particular, and all the different counseling resources, and not just the option of living in Arizona with his sister, but he is open to offering help, even though that he would rather not do that, just because he doesn't want to surround himself with people with the same struggles. He wants to surround himself with people who can help support him, like his sister and his mom, to help open him up and give him a positive influence and a positive structure, and I can't think of what I'm looking for, a positive role model, you know, of what he wants to be. But he also, you know, looked into Portland County, California, because here, he, just like in Arizona, where his sister is very structured and stuff, he would have even more structure here, because me and my mom are very close, and I work for the Sheriff's Department. My fiance works for the Sheriff's Department. Here, he would be not just under a microscope, but surrounded by all of these really great positive influences that, you know, we don't do anything that's not law-abiding just because of our standards. So I think that just that his desire to surround himself with these people who are positive and good role models and what he wants to be shows that he has grown and wants to continue to grow and even recognizes that there is room for growth. I really sincerely hope that you guys can see that growth that I have seen and, you know, give him the chance to continue to grow. And, you know, just let him have that chance that we all ask for every day. Do you guys have any questions for me?
I don't have any questions from the board. No questions. Thank you very much, ma'am.
Thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Are there any other supporters in the room for Mr. Shelton? No other supporters?
No, sir. Just the two
of us. Okay, I'm as procedural. And there are no, obviously, no one from the victim side. And Mr. Shelton, we're nearing the end of your hearing, and so it is your hearing. We'd like to give you an opportunity to make a final statement. Tell us anything else you can, you know, that you think is relevant and pertinent to our decision. We just ask that you don't repeat yourself for time management purposes. So now is your opportunity, sir.
You know, first of all, I'd like to thank you guys for, you know, hearing my family, you know, and people that care about me and listening to what I have to say. I don't have a lot more to say other than I'm not going to make this mistake again. And, you know, I know that I've made bad choices, but I also know who I am as a man and how hard I work and how I overcome, you know, how I'm going to overcome the decisions, as Mr. Johnson said, that I made, and I take full responsibility for. I listened to what all of you guys said, and all I can tell you guys is, look, I'm not going to do this again. We're not going to have to do this again. And I'll do whatever it takes to stay out and not have to go through this again. I'll be 50 years old in June, and I've spent over 3 decades in here. I'm ready to go back out there and stay out and do what I have to do the right way. And I hope you guys will give me that chance.
Okay, thank you, sir. The board will be going to discussion to make a decision. We work under the open meeting laws of Arizona, so anybody and everybody can hear our discussion. We don't discuss these before we get into the boardroom. So this will be the first time we actually have a board discussion on it. Stay on the phone, and we just ask you to remain silent while the board is in discussion, and once we're finished, I'll get back with you, sir, okay?
Yes, sir.
All right, the board is now in discussion. So this is an interesting situation. The totality of everything, I didn't feel much need to go back and really spend much time on the initial offense. At 16 years old, most kids are pretty well read into things that they wouldn't normally do or decide to do on their own. It was rather gruesome, but it also, and the pre-sentence report indicates there's some provocation going back and forth between the co-defendants and escalating it, and it wasn't very, very nice. But over the years, Mr. Shelton did pretty good, and we were able to convince the board back in 2013 that he was ready to back out into society and make a new life for himself. However, he almost lost it when he did his first violation of the conditions of release, and it was, you know, he was able to convince the board that it truly was a mistake drinking a NyQuil, like I say, a teenager by NyQuil so they can get drunk. They don't have to worry about buying specifically liquor and everything. So, you know, we had a good case though. And I know people who have been drunk on NyQuil because they took so much of it because they felt so sick. They didn't even think about what they were doing. So, you know, both ways. But once he got back on, he made some very bad decisions and ended up being not only getting reincarcerated, but being convicted of another of the new felony, which is what cutting off the monitoring device is in this state. I agree with Mr. Johnson, and a lot of it sounds like it's everybody else's fault. And that's one of the things he used to do, but at this time, I'd like to see a better release plan because it's, you know, I'm going to be out going with my sister, but there's been no approval by DOC, and with the previous history, I would think that would be a prerequisite to even considering a release. But I also think that it would be more convincing to DOC as well as myself if he had some, at least one of the halfway houses that specialize in it. I'm not talking about just normal halfway house, but the ones that have the program specifically to help lifers get back into society. And even if it's a program that doesn't include the housing, but it's a program that is specific to that kind of counseling, not these ones that are included in the packet, I would be more comfortable with that. But with everything involved here right at this time, I'm not in favor of returning Mr. Shelton to home arrest or regular or having discharge at this time. I'd like to hear a discussion from my fellow board members. Anybody have any? Mr. Canales.
I'll keep it short because I recognize that we've discussed quite a bit, and that is, as one voting board member, I would like to see a bit more personal growth from Mr. Shelton, especially in the context of personal responsibility and decision making. But I do want to say, as a point of encouragement, I see potential in Mr. Shelton, and I hope we'll take that message with him. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Canales. Okay, I agree with you on that. But overall, he's come a long way, and starting out 16 in prison, it's there's no doubt that his maturity wasn't along the same lines as somebody who wasn't in prison during that same period of time. But there's still with the self-defeating behavior, PTSD, whatever that might happen to be, that's what I'd like to see, a better solidity to the release plan. So, based on our discussion and all the information, I'm going to move to Ms. Rittenhouse.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
First thing that,
that's okay. I'm very impressed, and I think Mr. Shelton has done a good job of getting himself, making something positive. He's very articulate. To me, he's not your typical inmate. I mean, but understanding that he arrived there when he was 16 years old, he has a good start of a plan. He's been out and trying it, testing it, and he certainly has good support in his family. But there are just two things I want to bring up, and one of them is And this could be because he arrived in prison when he was 16, that his response to things is when it gets difficult is to run away. And that was the issue when he was a juvenile. Two different times, this incorrigible and then a couple runaways as a juvenile, and it's when things get tough, you run away. And that's what happened, you know, did it again with the GPS. In my mind, I can reconcile that with the fact that he came to prison at 16, and maybe that part of his thought hadn't developed, and so that was still his response as an adult, was to run away from a problem. The one that bothers me more is the discipline concerning the passing the note. Now, we all know that there's a way that inmates have to behave in prison to survive, and I respect that. I mean, I know it was just the prison culture. And I think he is a nice person. Both his wife and his stepdaughter said he's a nice man, he tries to do things for people. So when somebody passed him a note, probably any of us would do the same thing. We'd go, well, yeah, sure, I'll give it to him. You know, here, would you give this to so-and-so? Yeah, I'll give it to him. But the place that I can't get past is when the officer tried to get the note from him, there are ways he could have surrendered that note to the officer without losing his any sort of face in the prison system. There are ways, and he's been there long enough to know. But instead, he threw it in the toilet. So he was deliberately, at that point, I have to say, whose side are you on? You know, he was deliberately, and it's not even his thing, you know, so it's almost like just an instinct, and that bothers me. That truly does bother me. So I don't know, I would like to see more. He has a lot of insights about himself, but I'd like to see a little more growth, and that might be where you were going anyway. With what you had said before. Well, so thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, the more structured release is, with the history and the matter of the entry, more structured release, you know, is in order. And I think it's something you should look into specifically, rather than waiting for us to decide we're releasing them and say, well, where am I going to go?
So, any other discussion? Dr. Ray?
Thank you, Ms. Lee. I agree with distinguished colleagues. I think that one of my concerns, which is always, I guess, when we have a situation like this, is this board had given him an opportunity. And I know it's been, you know, 3 years since it gave him this opportunity. This opportunity was taken away from him. But whenever one violates, he had his freedom. He had it. And for whatever reason, and I know we've heard from his family and supporters, we've heard from him, but for other reasons, whatever the reason is, he violated that trust that was given to him by this board. We may not have been on the board at the time, but this board, the members of this board, gave him that trust, and then it was violated. Therefore, at this time, I'm just not in favor. Thank you.
If there's no other comments, I'm going to go ahead and make a motion at this time to deny Mr. Shelton home arrest, overthrow, or absolute discharge at this time. And that would be my motion, and then I'll go over the reasons after we vote.
Second.
Yeah, agreed. Are you asking for a set off?
Yes, I would do after when you're set off.
Agreed.
Yes.
Okay, reasons, we'll go back to the original offense on some of those. It was a serious and wild offense, loss of human life, a serious and legal offense, and the trauma to the victim, aid to the victim, severe bodily injury to the victim. Prior criminal history, but it was indicative of what was going on. Recent disciplinary infraction. I would say it means the closer supervision.
although it's a good release term, it's still back, so our market is approved in this term. Is there anything else anybody would like to add? No? Okay, Mr. Shelton, I'm sure you heard the discussion and the vote. We unanimously voted to deny him arrest, ready for active discharge at this time. We all have commendations for you, and you know, in your overall history, you've done well. And like Ms. Rittenhouse says, especially after having been incarcerated at the age of 16, it is, I know it's a tough situation, but there's a little bit lacking in your release plan, and I have to agree with Dr. Wright. It is it's just hard to accept the fact that the board voted to let you have your freedom actually twice, and then you did this violation. So it's a little hard to be in favor of any kind of release at this time. So, but you know, we do wish you luck. You can get a little more information, work on checking out some of the programs that are available in Arizona. It doesn't have to be a halfway house program. There may be programs out there where you have to do everything else on your own, but that you get into their program right off the bat and follow their closer supervision and their program to get you reintegrated. We would really rather see you back in society, whether it be in Arizona or California, but we'd rather see you back in society than to be in prison. We really would. But we have a hard job here, and some of the decisions we make aren't very enjoyable for any of us. But,
well, what's the reason for the year set up? I thought my sentencing statute says I'm going to see you guys every 6 months.
No, the date of the original crime was after July of 1984, so it's eligible for a 1 year set off.
Now, why is the year? What's the reason for a year? Because
that's what the board
has ordered like 12 times, and it's never been that.
Well, sir, this board voted today to do that, and that's our prerogative, and based on the totality of it, that was our decision. So, unless there's some other issue, this will end your hearing, sir.
All right, thank you.